Yeah, thanks a lot for the invitation. It's been great being here in this beautiful new building institute. And yeah, so I'll talk about a large field model of inflation in the context of string theory that's called axion monodromy inflation and its signatures. And most of what I'll be talking about is based on these three papers with Liam, Enrico, Alexander, and Gang. And the second one with Enrico, and then one that for obscure reasons was cross-listed today, even though it appeared in June, by with Mustafa, Richard, Hal, and Mark. And the outline is this. So I'll try to motivate our work in the sense that I'll try to motivate why large field models of inflation are interesting. And I'll try to motivate also why you should study large field models of inflation in the context of string theory or some other theory that I don't know an alternative, but some other theory where you can compute Planck-suppressed operator, the coefficients of Planck-suppressed operators. I will give you one proposal or a scenario of a large field model of inflation in string theory that goes by the name of axion monodromy inflation, and I will talk about the model-independent signatures, which is a bit of a funny way of saying it, because I'm talking about signatures of one particular model. But these are robust in this framework, and then there are signatures that may or may not be there, and then I'll conclude. Okay, so the motivation for us mostly comes from the study of the cosmic microwave background, which yeah, I show you some pictures here, which I'm sure you've all seen. More specifically, it comes from the study of the polarization of the cosmic microwave background, and in particular, comes from the study of B-mode polarization, mostly because in the context of inflation, if you see a B-mode signal or primordial B-mode signal, you're really seeing primordial gravitational waves. And those in the context of inflation, you only see if the inflaton moved over a distance large compared to M Planck in field space. And this is hard to realize in effective field theories, and you should study this in string theory. So this is roughly the motivation on one slide. I didn't include a lot of the definitions of things like the tensor to scalar ratio. I'll also later show shapes of non-Gaussianity and assume people know what they are, because I guess Matt and also Cliff told me that I can assume everyone knows these things. But if there's a definition that I'm not presenting and you would like to know what the definition is, just ask me and I'll do it on the blackboard. I don't want to lose you because I didn't define something. So just ask me and then I'll write it out, I guess. But so, okay, so it's on the one hand, measuring or having an indirect measurement of primordial gravitational waves is exciting in its own right, just because you really see quantum fluctuations in the space-time metric, which is a pretty cool signature. But it's also interesting in the context of inflation because it teaches us two more things. One is it teaches us about the energy scale of inflation, which is related to the tensor to scalar ratio in this way. So if you see primordial gravitational waves, or if you see a tensor signal in the CMB, then you know that the tensor to scalar that the energy scale of inflation was around the gut scale. And you also know, at least in the context of single field models, that the scalar field must have moved over a distance large compared to M Planck. And this relation was first pointed out by Leith a long time ago. So let me first tell you what we yeah. Yeah, I'm always working under the assumption that the vacuum is Bunch Davis. Okay, so what do we know so far from data? And the best bound we have is from WMAP7, which tells you that the tensor to scalar ratio is less than 0.24 at the 95% confidence level. And then with future experiments, we will probably be able to detect tensor modes down to a scale of about 10 to the minus 3. And I've summarized that in this plot, which is a bit busy, so let me tell you what some of the curves mean in case you haven't seen it. So the blue curves are just what the signal would look like, the B-mode signal, for different values of the tensor to scalar ratio. Here it's shown for 0.3, 0.01. Then these curves here, where it says WMAP, is roughly the sensitivity of WMAP, and you can see that you get roughly to R of about 0.2 with WMAP if you look at the forecasts. Then here you see the sensitivity of Planck. Planck realistically can measure a tensor to scalar ratio of about 0.05. And then there will be ground-based experiments that are interesting. And if these ground-based experiments see a hint, I would say then for sure there will be a mission like what's called EPIC here, or CMB pole, or cosmic inflation probe, which can get down to 10 to the minus 3 or even further, if depending on how well you can do on delensing, by which I mean there's also a contribution which is shown here as cosmic shear to the B mode from lensing of E modes. So this would contaminate the measurement. It's also the measurement is hard because there's synchrotron radiation and dust that can contaminate the signal. But so this is what we know. And so there's still a lot of room in field space. Remember that the border is roughly 10 to the minus 2, where you would talk about large field or small field. It's not a sharp line, but roughly that's where I would draw the line. And the reason this is interesting is, of course, that a motion of a scalar field over a superplanckian distance is hard to control in an effective field theory. And you probably know these arguments, but let me just give them again. So I'm considering a single field, an effective field theory that only has one light degree of freedom, and I'm limiting myself to terms up to two derivatives in the two derivative expansion, so I just have a kinetic term. And then all I have to tell you about to specify the model is the potential. The potential typically has a constant piece, then maybe it has a linear piece, but I can get rid of it by a field redefinition. It has a quadratic piece, cubic, quartic, and then higher powers in the field that are suppressed by the cutoff. So you see that if I wanted to move my field over a distance large compared to the cutoff, I would have to know all these coefficients, which in general I don't. All I know is that these are supposed to be, these Wilson coefficients are generically expected to be order one, but I don't know what they are. So you can ask, well, say someone gave you all these coefficients, can I then trust this model? And the answer should still be no, because generically, unless there are symmetries, this field should also couple to other modes in the system. In particular, it should couple to the degrees of freedom that you've integrated out with masses of lambda or larger. And the couplings of this field to these other modes will affect their masses. And in particular, as you move over a distance large compared to the cutoff, you should expect that some of the modes you integrated out become very light. And also, if you had a more complicated system with additional light degrees of freedom, you would always also expect that some of the light degrees of freedom would get pushed above the cutoff. So as you move a field over a distance large compared to the cutoff, the spectrum of your effective field theory is expected to completely change. And in particular, it seems that if you want to move it over a distance large compared to M Planck, you really don't know much about what you're doing. And I've tried to illustrate this in this simple two-dimensional model. So you have a field phi, which is going to be this field phi, and then you have a field psi, and I'm studying the theory around this vacuum. And these contours are the equal potential surfaces or lines. And so in this potential, you see in this vacuum, you see the phi field is very light. The psi field is very massive, so I can integrate out the psi field. I get some effective field theory like this. If I want, I can calculate these coefficients to arbitrary loop order. But the problem is still, if I were now to take this field phi, a distance large compared to the cutoff, there's no sense in which the system is well described by this effective field theory with one light degree of freedom. I should include the psi field into my description. So one way out of this is to say, well, I use a field that has a shift symmetry, then on the one hand, things are good because the VEF of that field cannot affect the masses of any of the other fields. I can move it over a distance as large as I want. On the other hand, also, things are bad because now that I have an exact shift symmetry, I'm either not inflating, or if I'm inflating, then there's no way to end inflation. So I have to break the shift symmetry, but now I can hope that I can do this in a controlled way by adding a single operator, hopefully, and then other operators will be generated by loop corrections. But as long as the initial operator that I'm adding comes with a small coefficient, then all these other operators have to be proportional to that small coefficient. The original, or the first model that I know along these lines, was by Fries, Freeman, and Olinto, which is a natural inflation. So you have the inflaton is supposed to be an axion, and you have this kind of potential. And if you could realize now an axion decay constant large compared to M Planck, then this would look at the bottom of the minimum, look like M squared phi squared inflation, and you could realize chaotic inflation in this type of model. Now, if you're talking about super Planckian field excursions, one should really also worry about M Planck suppressed operators, and so one should ask how if you can realize something like that in string theory. And it seems that realizing decay constants large compared to M Planck in the context of string theory is very hard. So the first example of a large field model of inflation in string theory in the context of type 2A was proposed by Eva and Alexander using D4 brains wrapping an S1 on the nil manifold. And then in the context of type 2B, more recently, there was a model by Liam, Eva, and Alexander, which is the model that we also looked at in this paper, and that's the model I'll be telling you a little bit about in a couple of minutes. And then there was an extension of this model to two axions by Marcus, Enrico, and Stefan that addresses some of the issues that these models have. And if you're interested in the study of monodromy just at the level of effective field theories, I included these two references. And okay, so this was my basic motivation. I guess the motivation for why large field models of inflation are interesting, I think they're interesting because they produce a tensor signal. And part two of the motivation is why should you study them in string theory? You should study them in string theory because in a large field model, you want to move the field over a distance large compared to M Planck, so you should study it in the context of a theory where you can compute M Planck suppressed corrections, which is the only example we have is string theory. So that's, I guess, my motivation. And I don't know if there's any questions. Okay. So then let me tell you the basic ingredients for the model. And the first question I guess you should ask is what's your inflaton? And just looking at the name, it's not too surprising that it's going to be an axion. So the question is, where do I get the axions from? And so if you consider string theory on M cross X, where M is some our spacetime, four-dimensional spacetime, cross some internal manifold, possibly with warping, so it doesn't have to be a product metric, then you get axions from integrating gauge potentials over the non-trivial cycles in your compactification manifold X. So for every, if you look at the B field, for instance, and you integrate it over a non-trivial two cycle, you get an axion. If you integrate a P-form gauge potential over a P cycle, you get an axion. And so you get one for every element in here. And it's easy to see at the level of supergravity that these fields inherit a shift symmetry from the gauge invariance of the action under the gauge transformations for the P-form gauge fields. But one can do even better and show that these fields have a shift symmetry to all orders in string perturbation theory, that is to all orders in alpha prime and G string. And the way to see this is by looking at the vertex operator for these fields in the limit of vanishing momentum. And it looks somewhat like this, where omega is the two form that's dual to the cycle the axion came from. The yi are the space-time coordinates. The xi's are the coordinates on my world sheet. And so you may recognize this as the pullback of this tool form to the string worldsheet, and I'm integrating over the string worldsheet. So instead of integrating the pullback over the string worldsheet, I can also integrate the tool form over the image of my string worldsheet in spacetime. And this vanishes if the string worldsheet is trivial. So if the worldsheet is the boundary of something, if I can contract it, then I can use Stokes' theorem to write this as the integral over C of d of omega, and omega is a closed tool form, so this is zero and there's no coupling, so no potential in the limit of zero momentum for this axion. The way to get around this is, one way is if the world, if there's world sheets that have a boundary, then this certainly isn't true. This means there's brains in the system. The other way to do it, or the other way to violate this, is if your world sheet is still closed, but it's not the boundary of something, so you have instantons, I suppose. And both of these mechanisms you will see in a second in the model. So let me look at the breaking by brains first. And for definiteness, I'll take a look at D5 brains later. For the model, for technical reasons, I'll be interested in NS5 brains. But let me take a D5 brain and imagine wrapping it on a two-cycle in the compactification manifold. So I take and extend along the four space-time directions. Then I can evaluate the DBI action. I can calculate the pullback of the metric plus B. And it looks something like this, so it contains a piece like this, which looks now like a potential in the four-dimensional theory for this axion field. And similarly, you could do this for the C2 axion. You find a potential that looks like this. And
what's L?
Oh, sorry, L was the size of this two cycle. So I'm assuming in all the formulas here, I'm just assuming I just have an S2 in this with size L. So the metric is L squared d theta squared plus sine squared theta d phi squared.
So L is not dynamical.
L is not dynamical in this. I mean, it's assumed to be stabilized in this. I mean, it would be a modulus, I suppose, but it's assumed to be just a number for this. Okay, so one thing to notice is that for large field values, this just becomes the square root of C squared, so it just becomes a linear potential. And for small values, it becomes quadratic. This will be important later on. I mean, that the potential opens up for this, for the discussion of oscillons in these potential. Okay, so I told you where the axion is coming from. The inflaton is coming from, it's this axion, and I told you where it gets its potential from. And you see that for large values, in terms of the canonically normalized field, you get a potential that just essentially looks linear. And I'm telling you how mu is related to the microscopic parameters, mostly so you see that it's easy to realize a mu that's small compared to Planck, which is what you need for Kolbe normalization. I don't think I included it anywhere, but mu has to be 6 times 10 to the minus 4, roughly, for Planck units for Kolbe normalization. And you can see that if I'm in the regime of control of my theory, L was the size of this two cycle in string units, so this has to be a large number, and G string has to be a small number. This is the warping, the warp factor at the position of the brain, so I can easily make this a number that's small, I mean 6 times 10 to the minus 4 in Planck units, and this is the expression for the C or for the NS5 brains, but the details are not important, just the potential looks like this and one can get this parameter to be small without working too hard. Okay. So now let me tell you roughly what it's supposed to look like in the context of this 6D manifold. And what we work with is, in practice, type 2B orientifolds with 0307 planes. And we stabilize the moduli a la KKLT, meaning that the complex structure moduli in the dilaton are stabilized by fluxes, and the Keller moduli are stabilized, in our case, by Gaugino condensate on the 7 brains. And what we want in this Calabi-Yau is we want to have some bulk Calabi-Yau up here, and then we want to have one throat that's generated by some large number of, say, 3 brains, some Klebanov-Strassler-like throat coming out of the Calabi-Yau, and we want that to bifurcate into 2 smaller throats. And we want there to be a 2 cycle in this small throat, and we want there to be a homologous 2 cycle over here in that throat for tadpole cancellation purposes. So we want then to wrap the NS5 brain on the 2 cycle over here, and the anti-NS5 brain on the homologous 2 cycle over here. And there's some, this just indicates that there's some one complex parameter family of these 2 cycles in the geometry.
He looks angry.
Say again?
He looks angry.
He looks angry or sad, yeah. Yeah. Okay, so that's the basic comic book image that you should have in mind for these models. And then when you build them, you have to make sure that the inflaton potential is smaller than the potential barrier stabilizing the moduli. You have to make sure the back reaction on the geometry is under control. And this is really, there's many subpoints. So you have to make sure, yeah, there's many subpoints. And I'm happy to discuss it, but I want to mostly talk about the signatures. But if you have questions also regarding maybe Joe Condon's paper, I'm happy to discuss these things. Higher derivative corrections should be negligible. Instanton corrections must be controlled. Or if you're lucky, you can use them to get interesting signatures. I'll talk about those. So let me tell you what we have in mind here, just again at the same level of drawing. So the idea is that there is some Euclidean D1 that's wrapping the same family of 2 cycles. And if you look at the warp factor dependence, then one of them, the NS5s, will sink down. The ED1 will tend to float up and be wrapping it somewhere else. But that's not so important. The upshot is that this would generate periodic modulations in the potential of this field. And we think it should appear in the Kähler potential roughly like this. I think all we know for sure is that it doesn't appear in the superpotential. It may also be that the whole dividing up in Kähler and superpotential is not so meaningful anymore at this point, but there is some oscillatory contribution to the potential of this inflaton from these effects. And so that's the basic model, and now I'll just talk about the signatures of these models in the CMB.
Question. Yeah. Is there a strong argument for why this would be an implicitly extended field problem and why you wouldn't have to worry about any axions? Or
no, I don't think there's a strong argument for why it's single field. In fact, one has to worry about other potentially light modes that we didn't study too carefully. I mean, yeah, you should. In principle, there could be many of these sectors, for instance, or even in this sector, you have to worry about some modes being light, like the KK modes living on these 5 brains are somewhat light. So there's modes in principle that one should worry about. Okay, so that was the stringy picture for the phenomenology. All you really have to remember is that the low energy effective field theory for this axiom monodromy inflation is supposed to be that of a single scalar field with canonical kinetic term, minimally coupled to gravity, with a potential that looks like this. Well, it looks like that while you're inflating, and toward the end, it looks quadratic. So you have a potential like this, possibly with modulations, and possibly also with couplings to other degrees of freedom. I won't talk about it much, but that was studied. Axions coupling to gauge fields, for instance, was studied by Neil Barnaby and also Lorenzo Sorbo, Enrico Marco Piloso, and I'm probably forgetting people, but this also has rich phenomenology, but I won't talk about it today. I'll mostly focus on the signatures that you get just from the single field model. Okay, so the first observable, which I called model independent, because it only depends on the linear potential, is the tensor to scalar ratio and the scalar spectral index. This is the usual plot of the tensor to scalar ratio versus the primordial tilt from WMAP 7, showing the quartic potential, which is essentially ruled out, the quadratic potential, inflation, and the Harrison-Soldovich spectrum. And you can just put the linear potential on here, and it sits very comfortably in this region. And the nice thing is that this tensor to scalar ratio is large enough that Planck would see it. So either Planck will rule this in or out. We'll know in, I don't know, I suppose less than 2 years whether Nature cares about this or doesn't care. Now the model dependent signatures. The first one I wanted to discuss are the oscillations in the primordial power spectrum. And these come from the cosine part of the potential. So if you have this cosine potential, then this low roll approximation actually breaks down, even though the background field seems to be slowly moving, but you have this periodic modulation. And you have to solve the Mukhanov-Sasaki equation. The reason this breaks down is not so much because epsilon or delta become large, but because there's parametric resonance in the system. And I'll explain that now. So to see this, the Mukhanov-Sasaki equation in the variables I'm using looks like this, where x is k over h, so the physical momentum relative to the Hubble scale. R is what's often also called zeta, I suppose. But so this is the equation it satisfies at the linear level. And it looks like a damped harmonic oscillator. Harmonic oscillator with friction, with frequency 1. And then epsilon and delta are this low-roll parameters, which you can work out for this potential. They look like this. And the details are not so important. What you should notice is they have sines or cosines, and that the argument of the sine and cosine is log of x, meaning that you scan all possible frequencies. So epsilon and delta oscillate, and the frequency with which they oscillate varies as a function of time. So you scan all possible frequencies. You also know that if you have a harmonic oscillator with friction and you either periodically modulate the frequency of the guy, or you modulate periodically the friction term with a frequency that's twice the natural frequency of the system, in this case just 2, then you get parametric resonance. So whenever the frequency in here is 2, you get parametric resonance. And also notice that here the coefficient is 3b times f times square root of epsilon. This is f in Planck units, which is a small number, and square root of epsilon is also small. So the oscillatory contribution in epsilon is small compared to the one in delta, and I'll focus on delta and look at that equation. So, x is k over ah, so roughly it's measuring time. It's the physical momentum relative to Hubble. Does it make sense? I mean, so can you, yeah. Okay, it just seems like a convenient variable to use. Okay, so at very early times, we're away from this parametric resonance where this frequency is equal to 2. And you can ignore this term because it's small compared to the one. When you're away from the resonance, you don't really care much about it. So you see that the solution is the solutions of this and just are Hankel functions, Hankel 1 plus Hankel 2. And at early times, I'm assuming I'm in the Bunch-Davis state. So I'll only turn on Hankel 1 with coefficient 1. And then at late times, far after the resonance, again, the solution to this equation is some coefficient times Hankel 1 plus some coefficient times Hankel 2. And at this time, I have to turn on the H2 because I might have excited something. And so a natural ansatz looks like this, where now you can write down an equation for the C minus. For large X, it looks like this. And you can solve this equation analytically, numerically, and you find that at large X, so deep inside the horizon, when K over AH is much bigger than 1, you start in the Bunch-Davis state, so C minus is 0. There's no excitation. And then you start with small oscillations. The oscillations get larger. At some point, you go through the resonance, and you've excited the state. So here, you really have an excited state. You have some contribution of C minus. And this happens for every mode when K over AH is some fixed value, which depends on the frequency of the background oscillation. Okay, so this is what the modes look like. And once you know what the modes are, it's easy to calculate the power spectrum. You just take the absolute value squared, and then you get a real part of C minus appearing, which looks like this. So delta in S, maybe a bit of a misnomer because it's not literally a change of the tilt, but we have some multiplicative correction, which is 1 plus this piece. Delta in S, you can calculate it, looks like this. And then cosine, so here phi sub k stands for the value of the scalar field at the time the mode with co-moving momentum k exits the horizon, and f is still the axiom decay constant. And there's really, strictly speaking, a phase in here that we don't know about. And that'll come up later in the data analysis. This is a kind of a complicated formula, and for the most part, we'll be interested in the regime where f phi star is much less than 1. So if you want to remember a formula, you can remember that one, but also that one you don't really have to remember. Now, the natural question is something like that there in the data? I think if it had been there, you would all know about it already. So safe to assume it's not there, essentially. But the question then is, what's the bound on it? And the constraints I'm presenting come from WMAP5. You might have said you can just do a naive Markov chain Monte Carlo, run it, and be done with it. What makes that a bit hard is that the likelihood function is very spiky. So one has to either be smart in the way you do the Markov chain Monte Carlo, or what we did is we did a grid-based analysis where we fix most of the cosmological parameters. So we fix all the parameters except the ones that are shown here. F is the axiom decay constant, which is a parameter we're interested in. Delta NS is the amplitude of the oscillations, which is also something we're interested in. Delta phi is this this phase that I just mentioned inside the cosine that we don't know. So we keep track of it and marginalize over it at the end of the day. We also marginalize, which I didn't show here, but we also marginalize over the amplitude. And we also marginalize over omega b because there is a region in parameter space where there is a degeneracy between these oscillations and what omega b does, roughly, because omega b changes the relative heights of the even and odd peaks, so the first and second peak in the CMB. And if you have the right frequency here, you can also do this. So we keep track of this and marginalize over it. For each of the points, so this is our grid. For every point on this grid, we calculate the CLs with CAMP. And then for the CLs, we calculate the likelihood with a WMAP likelihood code. It was then a modification of the WMAP likelihood code. It became the official version for some time. And we do this 33 million times and then marginalize over delta phi, omega b, and the amplitude. And then the resulting plots look like this. Both plots contain the same information. The only reason I'm showing two is because I find this one easier to remember for axiom decay constants above 10 to the minus 2 in Planck. So here the constraint is something like delta in S is less than a few percent. And this plot is easier to remember for axon decay constants below 10 to the minus 2, where the constraint is really on this combination on B times F, where the constraint is this is less than about 10 to the minus 4.
Sorry, what
is B? B, so we write our potential, it's parameterizing the amplitude of the modulations, and so the potential was mu cubed phi, and then we write it in a somewhat weird way, B mu cubed F times cosine of phi over F, so this is B. And the reason it was chosen this way is because it measures whether the potential is monotonic or not. So if you take the derivative with respect to this, you just get mu cubed times 1 and then minus, I guess, a B sine phi of F. So this measures if the potential was monotonic. Okay. So now you might ask, well, where is the, is there a best fit point? What is the improvement of the fit and so on? And the best fit point is somewhere in here in one of these peaks, around 6 times 10 to the minus 4 in Planck units for the axion decay constant. And the peak is kind of hard to see there. But the delta chi squared, if you're interested in that, was between 10 and 11 for this fit. I don't think this means much because I get similar improvements in the fit if I just take, the data, just CLs without any signal, and I do the same fit, I find similar improvements of delta chi squared if I fit these models. So I don't think there's really anything there, but there is naively a delta chi squared of 10 or 11.
And that's what?
Yeah, so this is the 1 sigma, contour, and 2 sigma contour.
It's just peaked higher in some other direction, and that's why that's the best sigma.
It's peaked here, okay, well, it's just that it is peaked in this plot, just comes out here, and the way these are drawn is just by the integral, not using delta chi squared, so really asking how much of you're just really doing the integral. There's not much weight in this peak. It's very narrow, but very skinny, and it sits somewhere here.
This is best likelihood for all the parameters, marginal over all of them.
Well, we marginalize not over all the cosmological parameters, but all of these, yes. Uh-huh. And if you wanted to know what it looks like, the angular power spectrum for the best fit value looks like this. So you see that you get these oscillations. And you might have asked, well, how is this consistent with the data? Because it usually looks so smooth, but clearly that's because the data is spinned and the real data looks like this. So you can easily imagine that you can improve the fit by wiggling around. And most likely you're just fitting some noise, but you can ask where the improvement comes from. I was worried initially that the improvement would come really from where the data is noisy, but the improvement really, if you look at where the delta chi squared comes from the first peak. I'm still, probably still doesn't mean anything, but.
Your bimodal spectrum, you said there was an oscillation in the bimodal spectrum, mm-hmm. but then you wrote it as a cosine of phi k or whatever. So that, how does it actually use in terms of k?
Okay, so.
Cosine k or cosine log k?
Cosine log k.
So this actually, if you compare that with the analysis that was made in 2005, something like that, with this exactly the same kind of transfunction situation that we're expecting.
With a cosine of k, you mean?
Cosine of log k.
Cosine of log k. Yeah, we looked at these papers, but I think they were doing a slightly different analysis in terms of the parameters. I think it's not inconsistent. I think it's the same type of analysis and also what they describe. That the likelihood function is spiky, all these things we find.
So it's actually also realized that the maximum.
Also the parameters.
Best chi square was actually coming from the rising of the.
Yeah. I think it's all consistent with their analysis. They had a slightly different parameterization, but we did match their values to our values, and it all seems consistent, I don't think. Okay, so this was the two-point function. Now you might ask, what about higher point functions? And this was first pointed out by Chen, Easter, and Lim, that if you have models with large delta dot, that you can get large non-Gaussianity. And what we did is essentially just give an analytic derivation of this. This was mostly numerical. We just did an analytic derivation that I'll tell you a little bit about, but it's okay. So here I'm abusing notation slightly, but what I want to calculate is the vacuum expectation value in informalism, if you want, in of these Heisenberg fields, and I can write this as the integral over time of the commutator of the interaction picture fields with the interaction Hamiltonian. And in the interaction Hamiltonian, you can focus on this term. All other terms are less relevant. This is the term that's highest order in slow roll parameters, so it's the one that you would usually throw out. But in these models, the more derivatives you take, the larger your interaction. So you should look for the term with the highest number of derivatives on the background, which is this one. And then we know the mode functions. I showed you the mode functions earlier. They're Hankel 1 plus the C minus of x times Hankel 2. The C minus, the modification, you can ignore because this is already first order in this parameter. So if you work at linear order for small oscillations, you can just use essentially the de Sitter mode functions or the slow roll mode functions. And just plug them in, evaluate the commutator, and you find something that looks like this, where now I didn't define what the G was.
It's quite sharp.
Okay, thanks.
So you can also push the board up if you want.
Okay. Yeah, okay, so the... Okay, so this G is defined in the following way. There's some factors of 2 pi, some normalization, then there's a delta function for translational invariance, k1 plus k2 plus k3, and then there is a 1 over k1 squared, k2 squared, k3 squared, and then there is this function, k1, k2, K3, K1, K2, K3. So this is what I'm showing here. And X, I guess, is just an integration variable, but really it is, if you want, it's K1 plus K2 plus K3 times tau, well, minus that. So the shape looks like this, and this is true for any model so far where you can ignore the correction to the wave function and you have some large delta dot. It looks like this. And then for our choice of delta dot that you get from this potential, you can evaluate the integral in the stationary phase approximation and you get this kind of shape where, so you get a sine of log of capital K, which is K1 plus K2 plus K3. With an amplitude that's given by this. And the interesting thing is, if you remember the formula earlier for delta ns, that if you keep b fixed, delta ns, if you make f small, decreases like the square root of f. This one increases like f to the 3/2. So this grows when you make the frequency. If you increase the frequency, this signal should go up. One thing one can check is that this actually satisfies Malasena's consistency relation, and this has to do with that's why I kept this second term. So in the regime we're interested in, f phi star is less than 1 because that's the regime where f becomes large. So this term in principle is negligible, but it's needed for this shape to satisfy the consistency relation. Okay, now I'm showing you this shape I fix K1 and then I show it as a function of K2 over K1, K3 over K1. And it's always hard to get oriented on these plots, so I'm indicating where the equilateral triangles are. So over here, all sides are the same. Here, one of them is squeezed. And here is the folded limit.
Are we supposed to see oscillations there or not?
You will see them as this is for a fairly large axion decay constant. As I decrease the axion decay constant, you'll see more oscillations. So this is the next plot. So you see as I decrease F, I get more and more oscillations. And the amplitude goes up. Okay, and so far I've always showed it for fixed K1, and most of the time it's fine to show the plots like this because they're scale invariant, but in this case it's really not a scale invariant shape. So I'm now going to show you a little movie where the K1 varies and you see what happens as a function of the K1. And yeah, you see that it varies logarithmically with K1. You see that it's getting slower as it goes on. And really, it's just a funny way of plotting it. If you had plotted it as a function of capital K, it would only oscillate essentially in one direction. But so these are the shapes that this model predicts. And then the question is, well, how would we tell if something like that is there in the data? And there's essentially two ways people look for non-Gaussianity in the data. One is you look for the local shape, the equilateral shape, orthogonal shape, and then you can ask in this case, is the overlap large between this shape and the shapes that are usually looked for? By overlap, I just mean some inner product on the space of these shapes, and which is, if I take the shape with itself, it's normalized to be 1, and if they're orthogonal, then it's going to be 0. And you see here, so I'm taking the overlap of the resonant shape as a function of the axion decay constant with, for instance, the local shape. And you see that in the regime where F is below 5 times 10 to the minus 3, which is motivated by the fact that here F and L is roughly 1 for these shapes. So in this regime, the overlap between the resonant shape and the local shape is always less than about 10%. And the same is true for equilateral and orthogonal shapes. So constraints on the equilateral and local and orthogonal shapes essentially don't give you a good constraint on the resonant models. The other nice idea is, so the reason people look at certain kinds of shapes is because factorizable shapes are easier to analyze. This shape is non-factorizable. I can say more about what that means if that doesn't mean much to you. A nice idea by Ferguson and Shallard was to say, well, if my shape may be non-factorizable, but I can expand it in terms of a factorizable basis and just analyze these basis elements, then the question is, does their expansion converge rapidly for these shapes? And they choose a polynomial basis, so it's not too surprising that it doesn't converge too rapidly. So I'm just showing here the overlap between the resonant shape and their expansion as a function for different values of x and decay constants and as a function of the number of basis elements you include. So for largish decay constants, it converges fairly well. For smaller x and decay constants where the signal is going to be larger, the convergence is very poor. One could try, this was done by Dan Meerborg, to use non-polynomial basis, and this improves it to some extent, but it's still somewhat hard to do the analysis in practice. And right now, I think there's no good constraint on this shape. So the one question you might ask is, well, given this best fit point, how large of an FNL would you expect there? Is it worth looking for this? And if you take the best fit point for the two-point function, you would expect for those values of parameters, an FNL of 1,200, which for these shapes, there hasn't been a proper study of the signal-to-noise ratio and what you're sensitive to. But naively, one would say I should be able to see something with an FNL of 1,200. But I suppose this remains to be seen. So also, if you're interested in what they look like, I'm showing you the angular bispectrum here, the diagonal part. I'm not sure, let me maybe briefly define what the angular bispectrum is. So because I also didn't define that. So I have the temperature is expanded in YLMs. The temperature maps, I get these YLMs, and then I can look at correlators like this. And by rotational invariance, they have to be proportional to some Clebsch-Gordan coefficients. L1, well, you know what the indices are. And then there's some reduced angular bispectrum, which is the one I'm plotting. And I'm only plotting the one where all L's are equal. And for comparison, it's very hard to see. I'm not sure if anyone can really see this except me. But here there is a line for the local shape as comparison. Ah, OK, good. Yeah. And then these are the resonant models as a function of, I mean, for different.
So, what are the SNLs that you are using for the other models?
What are the, so here the FNL is always the same.
1200 for?
No, sorry. No, this is always the, this is not, forget about what I said here about the 1200. These are all the same value of FNL, so all normalized to 1. The reason the amplitudes change is because you're integrating some rapidly oscillating primordial bispectrum against the transfer functions. So that's why the higher frequency ones have lower amplitude in the angular bispectra. But they had the primordial bispectra all have the same amplitude here.
So this shows my ignorance, but I mean, the way people normalize the FNLs, do they assume that you have the same biospectrum in the equilateral case when you say FNLs?
Okay, so there's different, yeah, some define it in the equilateral limit. There was a proposal by Ferguson and Schellert to define it in a different way, so all the error bars on the FNLs would be the same, which would be sensible. Here.
Okay.
Huh?
He gave me reading materials. Okay.
Oh, that was just about that. Okay.
But I guess what you're using here.
What I'm using is a somewhat random normalization. What I'm using is the primordial bispectrum. So here, this shape over K1, K2, K3 is some coefficient times a sign, and I just set that coefficient to 1. That's very random and not necessarily a good thing to do, but that's what's in the plot. So this is 1 for all of these. For the local shape, it's not. I mean, for the local shape, it's a different normalization. I didn't carefully compare them. This was just so you see, you have a rough idea what the local shape does at all, because it's not clear, you know, what it does. But here in the local shape, essentially, you're seeing the same acoustic peaks that you see in the CLs, in the angular power spectrum. And you just, yeah, mostly I included this because you can see that the amplitude of the oscillations kind of tracks what the local shape does. So it's large in the part where the local shape, where you see the acoustic peaks. Yeah. Okay, so let me talk about another. I'm not sure I would call this a signature, but it's something that may happen in these models at the end of inflation if the couplings to other fields are small enough, so the decay rate into these particles at the end of inflation is small compared to Hubble. So you may form oscillons. So let me first tell you what oscillons are, and I'm trying to show you what they are. So this is a plot, or was a movie, of an oscillon. So here, this axis is just in real space, in space-time. So this is a 1+1 dimensional model. And then here I'm plotting the scalar field amplitude, and oscillons are long-lived localized oscillatory configurations that just sit there and the scalar field goes up and down like you can see here. So roughly that's what an oscillon is.
How do I understand why it's singular once?
Why it's localized?
Yeah, why does it sit one once?
That depends on the potential. So generically, if the what's important here is that the potential kind of flattens out, then you can find these localized solutions. If your potential were not flattening out, or you have just m squared phi squared, this doesn't happen. If you start in a blob like that, then it just radiates its energy off to infinity. If it's localized, you can if the potential flattens out, you can find these solutions that stay localized. You can roughly you can understand it, I think, by looking at the equation of motion for the scalar field. So you look for something that has phi double dot minus, well, let me call it m squared phi and then plus v double prime minus m squared phi equals zero. So roughly you're solving something like this. And you can, so here I'm looking for something that oscillates with a frequency omega. And you get something, you can rewrite it like this. And then you can convince yourself that for these localized solutions, I can find a regime with it. So this is positive, and then for this solution, for this equation to have a solution, I need this to be negative. So the potential has to flatten out. As if that doesn't happen, then there's no such solution. But if the potential flattens out relative to the quadratic potential, you can find these. You need
some defects. So what was happening here? You have some defects under potential or take this oscillation.
No defects. I think the statement is just that if you look at these field configurations, they solve the equations of motion. And maybe it helps that they're closely related to cue balls, if that helps in any way. Cue balls are similar configurations, except they're made stable by some U1 symmetry. Here, there is no U1 symmetry. But if you want, you can think about it in the following way. So you really, we're going to be looking at these at rest. So you can think of taking some non-relativistic limit. And there, the number of particles is some approximate symmetry that protects these. OK. Yeah, so the calculations that I'm going to show assume that the couplings to the degrees of freedom on the brain, or in general, to the degrees of freedom, to other degrees of freedom in your system, are small in the sense that the decay rate of the inflaton into those quanta at the end of inflation is supposed to be much less than Hubble. So really, the self-couplings of the inflaton are the relevant couplings. And then, yeah, you can show then that the oscillons are stable if the potential flattens out for large field values. And it's interesting that you don't have to tweak the initial conditions. You just start with these inflationary models, and you go through a phase of parametric resonance when the scalar field oscillates around the bottom of the potential, which produces these oscillons. So the inflaton fragments and forms these oscillons. And this is shown in this movie where I should have, maybe before I showed it, said exactly what's happening. But this is a simulation of the scalar field in an expanding background. So gravity is not dynamical. There's some expanding background, but it's self-consistent in the way that you're solving the background equations for the scalar field. But perturbations in the metric are not taken into account. And you just let the field go, and you see that you form these blobs, which the contours that are shown here are where delta rho over rho, I think, is something like, I don't remember, some fixed number, I think 3. So these are just over dense regions, and they sit there for a long time. And yeah.
The expansion here is set by what? Is it
by the
elimination?
Here, this is done in a consistent way, so it becomes matter dominated because these blobs just then these are essentially like particles. At some point, this just becomes matter dominated. Yeah, I suppose, but we haven't studied the gravitational collapse of these systems. So, but yes. And these still have to decay. I mean, you still have to reheat. At some point, you still have to produce radiation. Right. If it doesn't, then it doesn't work. Yeah, but there seems to be a long regime where you're saying the couplings have to be small at this period, but they have to be large enough for you to reheat before Big Bang nucleosynthesis. I think there's a long window. Okay, yeah, this I guess was essentially what I wanted to say. So it seems that string theory has the right ingredients to realize large field inflation. The scenario, this axion monodromy inflation, it has interesting signatures. One of them is just a large tensor to scalar ratio and some prediction for the scalar spectral index. And either you see this or you don't, so the model will be alive or dead in the next 2 years. I mean, I don't know. And maybe if you're lucky, you can see a modulated temperature anisotropy spectrum as well as resonant non-Gaussianities. These resonant non-Gaussianities are poorly constrained and I think deserve further study independent of the stringy scenario. And oscillons may form at the end, but this is a model-dependent question, depends a lot on the couplings to other things. But also independent of this, it seems interesting to look at these oscillons in more detail, look at the subsequent evolution, see what happens with their gravitational interactions. The field theory interactions certainly are included in the code, but I don't know what happens when you make them cluster. We don't know what happens if you maybe form primordial black holes, or no one really knows. And yeah, I mean, I guess more explicit geometries would be nice, and reheating should be studied, but the models are interesting, and I think that's all I wanted to say, so thanks.
In the movie you showed, you have the resonant Gaussianity, you showed how the amplitude actually depended on K1, the base wave number that you were comparing to. Does that mean that you have like a strong running in your Gaussianity?
If you want to think about it in terms of running, you can think about it in terms of running, but it's not, it's a oscillatory running. But it's a sine of log of capital K, so there is, it goes up and down, it oscillates.
But it looked to me like in the movie that the amplitude of the oscillations were increasing as you changed the scales you were
looking at. That shouldn't be. I mean, it's some constant, so good first approximation, it's some constant times the sine of log of k.
Okay.
So the amplitude is fixed.
The amplitude should have been fixed, in
yeah.
It's just the theory that changes.
Mm-hmm. So you said the model will be ruled out in a couple of years, but of course, I mean, you can tune the parameters so that the tensor to scalar ratio is small, right? So
I think that's hard because it only depended on the fact that the potential was linear. So
if you decrease mu, but I guess
it's still a linear potential. Mu is essentially fixed by Kolbe normalization, and then it's really only the shape of the potential that you're measuring when you're measuring NS and the tensor to scalar ratio. So you have to get away from the linear regime.
Oh, okay.
It's that's ways of realizing models that don't have a linear potential. There's other stringy models that don't have a linear potential, but in this model, I think, I mean, yeah, you can get phi to the 2/3, phi to the 5/8. There's many different models, and in that sense, those would still be alive potentially or not, but this, I think the linear potential really fixes in SNR.
Okay.
So you already mentioned the transprandium physics, the 2005,
yeah.
Also produces this oscillatory behavior.
Mm-hmm.
So is there a genesis here? How do we distinguish one from the other?
Yeah, that's a good question, I suppose. I mean, in I haven't thought about it.
The difference is one is real, the other is imaginary. But it's just a trans-Planckian physics. There are lots of different proposals for what it is, and everybody has a different opinion.
That's right. Anyway, so
in
which
you
seem to be generated solution.
Yes.
But now, if you talk about
just,
the non-Gaussian energy, that might be different.
Mm-hmm. The two-point function.
I don't think anybody actually has looked at the effect of trans-Planckian effect on non-Gaussian energy, or maybe somebody has. I mean, if they affect the power spectrum, they're going to affect non-Gaussian energy.
Certainly. Yeah. Another question is, the two-point function is exactly the same, more or less. So, suppose that the three-point function is okay, whether it would be different or be that way.
Mm-hmm. But it is an effect of the initial condition, right? See why it would be different from the, what people look like on Gaussian energy from the initial condition. They're the same as far as signatures go. I think one way of thinking about it is that here you have a way of explaining why you should look at an excited state. So here there's some dynamical mechanism that excites a state, and the other one you just put it in and say, well, maybe something excited the state. But I think at the end of the day, the same, the motivation is different, the signatures are probably the same.
Paul Schaller actually mentioned that in a Hong Kong conference whether they detect oscillatory non-Gaussian indicators.
Yes, but they looked not at the sine of log k, they looked for the sine of k, which comes from the bump features. And there, I wouldn't say they detected it, it's just that they look at a lot of different shapes, and at some point you're bound to have a three sigma detection. If you look at 100 shapes, you're going to have just statistically some three sigma detections. So there you have to really be careful about assessing what the sigmas mean if you look for that many shapes. If they have these nice plots, I don't know if that's the paper you had, but they have these plots where they show it on a grid of the as a function of the phase and the amplitude, and there are, it seems, so you can vary the position of the bump in that case. And it seems there are some 2-point x sigma detections, but I'm not really sure what they mean. If you look at water 50 models, it's not so surprising. But yeah, I agree, they did that. Yeah, for the bumps.
Questions?
Yeah.
Questions?
Yeah.
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 Yeah.